the Q stuff, like, I'm not personally scared. I'm more just feel scared for the society that we are now living in and that there's no turning back. And I alternate between being really depressed by that, but also trying to keep some sense of humor about it all. I mean, life is absurd just from like the get-go. I think you understand that as well as I do. It's weird that we're alive and breathing in the first place. So all this other stuff is just like weird little side plates that we've just got to live with.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. I am David Chen, and I hope everyone out there is staying safe, staying healthy, doing what you need to do to keep yourself and the loved ones around you out of harm's way. Today, I'm going to be speaking with David Ferrier, a journalist and filmmaker who I have a great deal of affection for. I first discovered David Ferrier's work in 2016 when he made a film called Tickled. And it was a journey into the dark side of tickling. It's a fascinating, enthralling movie. In the U.S., it's been available on HBO in the past. I think I recently saw it available on Hulu, so you can check it out there. But he recently started a paid newsletter that also has issues available for free. We're going to talk about it later on. Before we get to that, though, I do have a minor announcement that I'm going to cover more in detail later. And that is, hey, I've recently launched a Patreon. I've gotten to the one-year mark of Culturally Relevant and gotten to the point where I feel like, hey, I think I understand what the show is, what it can be. I have some sense of what people are appreciating about it. And, of course, I'm always open to more feedback. If you have thoughts on what I should be doing with the show or how it can be better, feel free to always email me at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com or just tweet at me at crevshow, C-R-E-V-S-H-O-W. That would be great. That being said, I have launched a Patreon page at patreon.com/DaveChen. And I think I'm going to go more into detail in a later episode about why I'm doing this and what exactly I'm hoping to accomplish with this. But in the meantime, just know that if you are a fan of my stuff, and in general, I think if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are, and you want to support me, you want to support me making more things, support me committing more time and more resources to making things, there is now a very easy way to do that. Go to patreon.com/DaveChen. That's patreon.com/DaveChen. And a bunch of people have already started contributing. I really appreciate it. There are some cool rewards on there. But really, the reason to go to patreon.com/DaveChen and kick a few bucks per month my way is just because, hey, you want to show you've been a fan of my stuff in the past and you want me to keep making more stuff. And that's what I'm going to try to do. Both for the general public, such as yourself listening right now, but also probably some bonus things for the people who contribute some money to the Patreon. So thanks again to everyone who's already donated, and again, more on the way in the future about that. But in the meantime, I am so thrilled to introduce my guest today. David Ferrier is a New Zealand-based journalist. He's the director of the documentary Tickled, and he's one of the forces behind the TV show Dark Tourist on Netflix. He's currently writing a newsletter called Webworm, which shows his investigations into quirks and oddities, his words. You can subscribe to Webworm right now. I'll link to it in the show notes. I was really excited to talk to David both about his past work and how he got to where he is today, but also New Zealand, as you may or may not be aware, has had a very different response to the coronavirus pandemic. One, I would argue, is wildly more successful than the United States response. That being said, as you'll hear, the coronavirus pandemic is still impacting even someone like David in various ways. So it was great to talk to him both about what he is doing to cope with the current situation, how he's thinking about the current situation. But in general, we also spoke about conspiracy theories and what we think is behind them and tips we have for tackling those kinds of things that may or may not be useful. I hope you find this conversation as enjoyable as I did. Here is my conversation with David Ferrier. And just for kicks, I'll put a little trailer for Tickled. So you can hear a little bit of his work right now.
I can't say I've ever interviewed anyone that looks like you before.
Really? I've made a career out of looking at the weird and bizarre side of life.
It's quite a kick.
So when I discovered a strange video online, I knew I'd found my next story.
CET, competitive endurance tickling group we got here.
Competitive endurance tickling. It was one of the strangest sports I'd seen. So I told Jane O'Brien Media I'd like to do an interview. Instead of getting a yes or no, I got this.
Association with a homosexual journalist is not something we will embrace.
Shame on you.
You don't gay Kiwis. Regards, Jane O'Brien Media.
It was hard to take the insult seriously, considering the sport did seem slightly gay. This tickling wormhole was getting deeper.
I mean, obviously it's just for fun.
Is it just for fun? It's tickling.
You know, I was young at the time, didn't think nothing of it. And I was like, $2,000, that's gonna be cool.
I mean, imagine being a teenage boy. She would just keep sending them whatever they wanted.
She offered my one buddy a Chevy Cruze and $30,000. The money's endless.
This tickling empire is way bigger than we ever imagined.
They have tickle cells all over the US. They're everywhere.
And at some point, these boys say, I'm done.
David Farrier, thanks so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
So I'm good. I'm in New Zealand. We were COVID-free until a couple of days ago, so we're sort of in a semi-lockdown again. But apart from that, I can't complain.
Yeah, I mean, I want to ask you real quick about that. How many people constitutes a lockdown situation in New Zealand right now? How many cases?
Well, it sounds ridiculous when you look at what's happening in the rest of the world, and especially the United States, but we went into a lockdown in Auckland, which is our biggest city where I am, when we had four cases tested positive for COVID-19. So what we've been trying to do is just stop any sort of community transmission. So we had like 100 days or so of nothing. And this marks a change from that. So the idea being we can stamp it out and go back to life as normal. But it's definitely got people a little bit concerned here.
Well, if only we had that level of concern for four cases. I think we're at about 2,200 cases per hour in the United States. So
it's wild, Dave. It's wild looking at it from over here.
Yeah. I want to talk with you more about that. But first, typically, I like to begin these conversations by asking about breaking in stories. Now, I actually want to go back further in time before your breaking in story.
To my birth.
Day. To when you emerged from your mother's vaginal canal. No, I want to ask you when you first realized you kind of had a unique fascination with some of the darker, more upsetting elements of human nature, which I assume predates your breaking into media.
It's a good question, actually. And I think, to be honest, because I grew up in a fairly conservative Christian home. And so I think it was when I was introduced to the X-Files in the 90s that my brain suddenly realized there's this whole other world out there. And I got very excited by this idea of all the stuff I'd been pretty cut off from, in a way. It just kind of sort of awoke my mind to the stranger side of life. And then, obviously, I didn't go down the path of just becoming a UFO-obsessed cryptozoologist. I kind of started just looking more widely into the unusual parts of life. And then when I was eventually trying to get into medical school, I started writing for the local student magazine. And I sort of enjoyed exploring ideas through there. And then very quickly, I just kind of moved from the idea of going into, you know, what I wanted to do, which was medicine, and I got into journalism, which is a questionable decision, but one I'm glad I followed.
I was a huge fan of the X-Files as well. I remember, I think it was on Friday nights on Fox in the United States, and I would always make sure to record it on my VHS cassette tapes.
I was exactly the same. Yeah. And I would sometimes, if I didn't finish an episode that night, I'd watch like the rest of it the following morning before school. And I remember buying this, it was so expensive, a VHS box set of like episodes from the first season. There was like Tombs and maybe like two other VHSs that like went into this like cardboard sleeve. It was so expensive and I was so excited to get it.
When you think back to your love of X-Files, kind of what are the most memorable moments or episodes that kind of, like, you know, we all have kind of mental images that we bring up when we think of something, when we remember something, right? So when you think of X-Files, like, what is the episode or what are the images that come to mind?
Image-wise, the stuff around the abduction of Samantha Mulder's sister, like the sort of the ship and this idea of this kid sort of with this beam of light, that stuck. But I
her floating out the window, right? Like that image.
Iconic shot. And it's also, it's kind of seized in my brain because I collected like the collector's cards of the first season, which has all these like these sort of iconic shots. And so it kind of bleeds into that as well. But I think like overall, the episode Home made this really big impact on me. Because
I was
going to
say Home as well. Home is my episode that I recall when I think of X-Files. Yeah.
It's so dark. The story is so bleak. It was really bold. The music choices were really good, and I think that coupled with I think it was like Jose Chung's From Outer Space, which was more of a comedic unusual episode, that also made this huge impact on me at the time. So those are my two go-tos.
Home and Jose Chung, great episodes. I mean, Home, it really opened my mind to what the human mind was capable of creating, you know, in terms of like, wow, like that someone could create something that upsetting, right? It really kind of expanded my horizons in terms of what is possible with media, I think. But yeah, incredible episode of The X-Files. I think it was season 4 is Home. I'd recommend people check that out. And I also Little Green Men, I think, was an episode that I really really got to me as well. So yeah, those are my episodes. But yeah, I think we both have a really big appreciation of the X-Files.
It was such a new world, and it was like new ideas, and it was storytelling done in this with these big, you know, giant season arcs that hadn't really been done before. So yeah, I think like a lot of people our age, probably The X-Files sits there pretty high.
When you think about your breaking in story, and like, I guess my question is, how do you really think of yourself right now? Do you think of yourself as a filmmaker? Because before I would think like you were, I guess, a journalist / on-air personality in New Zealand, right?
I was. It's a good question because I struggle, and I have a lot of imposter syndrome as well. And being a New Zealander where we're all very like worried about talking ourselves up, I think that hits even harder. But I think primarily I'm a journalist because I'm proud of that profession, and it's where I trained, and I worked in a newsroom here in New Zealand for about 7 or 8 years before I ended up making Tickled, which was a bit of a fluke. And you know, I love documentary, but I don't like calling myself a documentary maker because I don't think I've made enough documentaries to really sort of call myself that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I made Tickled, mm-hmm. which was this like weird kind of fluke, and I made that with my friend Dylan Reeve, and that kind of came together really quickly. And then, you know, I'm Dark Tourist. It was this travel show. I think bits of it were really good. I think bits of it we could have done better. I'm working on another documentary at the moment, but like I want to have like a few under my belt before I sort of wander in and go, I'm David Farrey, I'm a documentary maker, you know, because it's because
wow.
I kind of bristle when people call themselves documentary makers as well. It's like, I don't know, maybe it's just that just that New Zealand thing of being like very understated, but I don't know, I'm no Werner Herzog, you know, like, so I like to call myself a journalist. I love journalism, I love writing, and I think that, you know, documentary is just a part of that.
What was the first story that you worked on that really made you think of journalism as something that could be your career, or that really made you realize what the power of journalism could be?
Well, I started in a very like poppy way. So when I first started in New Zealand, you know, I worked on this late night news show where, you know, I did the entertainment round. So I could sort of talk to any visiting actors or musicians that were in town. And I think the time where I kind of thought, hey, like, this is kind of special is the guy, the lead singer from System of a Down moved to New Zealand. And I, you know, I love my metal, you know, like I'm a white guy in his like late 30s, right? I grew up on like metal music. And meeting him, I realized that I could meet someone, I could get their ideas, I could package it up in a way, and then, you know, broadcast it to the country, and then obviously online sort of further than that. And you know, he's a really political guy, so he had a lot of things to say, not just about his band System of a Down, but he was talking about the Armenian genocide, which I knew nothing about. I think a lot of New Zealanders didn't know anything about. And that story went out, and I just got so much feedback from people that were fans of the band, or not fans of the band, but were sort of fascinated by what had been raised, that I kind of went, oh, this is a tool I can use to go beyond just kind of getting the get of like an entertainment thing, like just not get excited about like my 2 minutes with Leonardo DiCaprio speaking about some like film he's made. I could flesh out ideas and get them out to people. And that became really appealing. And then obviously it morphed more from entertainment into investigative stuff. But that was a number of years later.
So a number of years later, you made Tickled, which was one of my favorite movies of that year. You obviously are aware, I talked it up quite a bit on the Slash Filmcast.
That was surreal for me because, you know, I've been listening to the Slash Filmcast for a long time by then. So to suddenly hear about something I had made be talked about on this podcast I love, like I'm not just like talking you up, but that was a really surreal experience for me. So thanks for that.
Yeah,
Dave.
It's great when people have a mutual admiration for each other. It's rare, but it's awesome when it happens.
And just for the record, I also loved how much Jeff hated Tickled as well, because he's I just really love that, and it was a great joy just hearing you both talk about it. Like I really enjoyed that process.
So 2016, Tickled came out. You debuted at Sundance, and I think it was on HBO. And then now I think it's on streaming services, right?
Yeah, it's funny. It hops all around. I think it's on Hulu at the moment. It jumps around.
Yeah. And then in 2018, you released Dark Tourist on Netflix. Now, I remember talking with you about Dark Tourist at the time, and it was like an order of magnitude or multiple orders of magnitude difference in terms of your level of fame and recognizability after Dark Tourist hit Netflix in the US. Am I characterizing that correctly? And can you talk about like how you experienced that? Like what was the tangible experience of releasing a Netflix show versus something that went from Sundance to HBO?
Yeah, I mean, it was, for me, it felt huge because I knew Netflix was big and I knew that it was in a lot of different territories, but I hadn't quite clocked that a thing I'd made was going to go out in multiple different languages and be seen by so many people. I mean, when Tickled was on HBO, like I thought that was as wide as something could ever go. You know, I grew up watching HBO shows. I grew up watching The Sopranos. So the idea that it was on HBO with Tickled felt huge. But Netflix, it's just everywhere. And it's just, I'm not saying I'm bloody Zac Efron or something, but if I'd be traveling around in the States, I would suddenly, you know, I'd be on a walk somewhere or I'd be in Japan and people do come up and want to chat about the show. And it's really encouraging and it's really cool and it's really interesting. And it's great because I'm not that level of knowability where I'm walking around getting harassed by people. It's purely like people that liked it, they might recognize me. And then instead of not saying anything, they'll come up and say, hey, I saw this thing, I like this or I didn't like this, and it's a conversation. So yeah, the power of Netflix is insane. I was talking to Erin Lee Carr has sort of like kindly mentored me and given me some advice, and I love her work, and she's been on your show, I know. I like that episode. And she, when her stuff, she had a series on Netflix, and she was just the same as me. She was just like, holy shit, I am hearing from, this goes so wide. I'm hearing from so many people. Like, this is crazy.
Yeah. Erin Lee Carr, love her, friend of the show, and super talented documentary filmmaker. And I'm curious, you know, my sense was that Tickled was universally praised, like pretty universal. Everyone loved it, other than Jeff Cannata on the Slash Filmcast. And, but Dark Tourist got a little bit more criticism because of how it handled some of the subject matter. And so I'm curious, like, do you consume reviews of your own work? And if so, did you take away anything from how people talked about Dark Tourist specifically?
Yeah, no, I do. Like, I'm online so much, and I mean, for my work so much, you know, I've sort of been a critic at times, or tried to be, and, you know, I'm curious what people are saying. So I'm pretty open reading stuff, and I guess I was fortunate enough with Dark Tourist where, like, it wasn't, like, all terrible. Like, some people really loved it, and it's been a real positive for me overall. But, like, to be honest, like, any negative reviews, like, I kind of got what they were on about. I mean, essentially, I don't know. I mean, essentially, we're in 2020. I think any sort of travel show where you've got like a privileged white guy, like traveling around the world, making any kind of commentary on the world around them, I think it's a bit of an old model, I suppose. And, you know, no one's going to do it like Bourdain did. One thing, so there's that. But then I'm also like incredibly proud of some of the things we did in that as well, because I think we pushed into areas that were uncomfortable. And the whole idea around the show is that it was sort of pulling apart the ethical questions around, you know, the ethics of a serial killer tour, or, you know, cashing in on these places where sort of terrible things had happened. And I think certain elements we got, like, we kind of nailed, and other bits we probably could have done better. Like, to answer your question, I do read all the comments, and generally, I don't know, I kind of get it. Like, I get people that liked it, I get people that didn't like it, and I'm kind of into it all.
Is there something specific that you look back on? You know, as somebody who makes content myself, not of the same kind of magnitude as what you've done in terms of reach, but I think, like, I feel like I am my own worst critic. You know, I have by the time a TV show or film or whatever has come out, the person who's creating it has watched it dozens of times, if not hundreds of times, right?
Oh yeah.
And so you know it better than anyone else. And I'm curious, like, as you look back on it, you know, Tickled is like a pretty cut and dried case of, like, you took down this bad dude, you know, and it's like you took down this bad dude, you did it in a way where you told the story in a really compelling fashion. Dark Tourist story is a little more complicated, right? Because you're not taking down bad dudes. You are making people uncomfortable, putting them in situations they wouldn't otherwise be in, the viewer specifically I'm referring to.
Mm.
And so as you look back, is there anything specific that you're like, oh man, I really feel like I missed the mark on this, or, you know, I wish I'd done this a little bit better?
I think, like, to be honest, I think with that show, and, you know, it was a team around me. Like, Dark Tourist was... I mean, Tickled was like my baby from the get-go. And, you know, my friend Dylan came on board and he got it. And he, like, we both pushed the story forward, and it felt like very personal. And we kind of knew what we wanted to do, and we were learning along the way. I think, and that kind of ticked all the boxes in my sort of journalism brain, where you're getting to a new truth. You know, that a lot of documentaries are retelling stories that have already happened, whereas I feel like with Tickled, we had this really special thing where we were discovering a new story that had never been told in this way.
Right.
And we're exposing something new. And sure, it wasn't exposing, like, Jeffrey Epstein, but it felt like a discovery. Whereas, I mean, essentially, Dark Tourist was a travel show. You can be, like, lofty about it and be like, that was a documentary series, and it was a documentary as well, but it's a travel show. And
there's that word again that you hate.
Yeah, it was. But we weren't out there, like, I wasn't out there, like, trying to take anyone down or get to any particular truth. It was more observational, and it was more opinionated from my perspective, and it's a different thing. And so, you know, for instance, you know, when we're in Myanmar, for instance, like, there are some massive issues you could dive into there journalistically, to an absolutely bonkers degree. That wasn't our show. Like, we were a show about this type of dark tourism, and there's certain things that I'd naturally want to dive into. I mean, Turkmenistan, just the human rights abuses there, like, this whole, that could be a whole film, and yet we were there kind of with this tourism angle. So, God, I can't even remember what your question was, but I guess the thing with Dark Tourist that was interesting is that it was a travel show more than a documentary. And I think what I guess I discovered over making that is I'm definitely more passionate about the pure doc side and the discovery side more than sort of a human interest angle. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But my question was basically, like, as you're looking back on it, are you like, oh, I wish I had done this differently? You know what I mean? Or there's some specific thing that you wish you had tackled differently?
I just, as far as the construction of that show, like, I would love it if I didn't have to do as much voiceover. So much of that show is me narrating my thoughts and talking and filling things in. And if I, like, from a directorial point of view, I would love to go back and be able to be more in the moment with my thoughts and certain things. I wish that in Turkmenistan I'd been able to push harder and get a sit down with the president of Turkmenistan, because he is this whole other level of crazy. not only is he a, you know, part-time DJ, and he's also just an awful human being. Like, he is objectively awful. And I would have loved to have been able to like push and sit down with him. But instead, you know, I cut my hand and got shot up on ketamine and it ended up being a whole other show. So yeah, I reckon Turkmenistan, I had different ideas for that. I met Popeye's hitman in Colombia, and I think I could have pushed harder in there and got some more stuff out of him. He's dead now, he died of cancer, so that's never going to happen. But yeah, those are probably the two things, Popeye and Turkmenistan.
The only time those two things have ever been brought up together in a sentence.
Totally normal.
So you recently have started a newsletter on Substack, right? The newsletter is called Webworm. Substack's a service that people can use to create kind of a one-to-one relationship with fans. People can pay for newsletters, pay to support people. A lot of media personalities are shifting towards this as a way of surviving and sustaining their work. For me personally, David, it's a challenge to figure out where I'm going to put my time. You know, there's so many things I want to do, like YouTube, podcasts. I want to write blog posts, like all this stuff. And that's separate from my actual job.
Oh, you were out of control, David. Like, there's no doubt you were out of control. Someone needs to rein you back in.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, but my question for you is, like, why did you decide to go with a paid newsletter versus, say, like, a podcast or a YouTube channel? Like, you're obviously very talented and you have, like, a pretty big following online. Why newsletter specifically?
A few reasons. For one thing, I knew I wanted to write. So I wanted something that I could do where all I needed was like my laptop or my phone. I didn't need any video gear. I didn't need any audio gear. I could just sit down and write. And a lot of the things, I mean, this was stuff I was already doing before. You know, I would write for certain publications, my weird little investigations. I mean, that's where Tickled started. It was like three long form written pieces before I made the film. So I find print a really good way of testing an idea and putting it out in the world, getting more leads. And so I knew I wanted it to be written. And then combined with that, we went into lockdown in New Zealand, where suddenly, you know, I was shooting my next documentary here in New Zealand and I couldn't do that anymore. And I was spending a lot of time on Twitter and Instagram, and I was doing really long Twitter threads about different things. And I just thought, God, if these platforms disappear, these people that follow my stuff are going to disappear. I've got no way to communicate with them. What's the point? And then around that same time, my friend started Substack. And so he messaged me and was like, I think you should like try writing a newsletter. And I was sort of, I talked it through with him a bit. And then I really like the model where you can essentially release stuff for free, but then have a version where people can pay if they want to. And I just thought I'd try it. And I started, and I really loved it, and I love the response, and I love the community that's come up around it. And I love the idea that if people want to financially support it, I guess it's like Patreon, right? Like, you're getting this like monthly amount of money that will help you live your life, and it gives me the resources to go and like do other stuff, like shoot a sizzle for a doc I want to make. So I love the format. I like writing, and I'm just kind of curious where it will go. And I guess at the moment, I'm writing a lot about conspiracy theory culture and QAnon, which is something that I had pitched as a kind of as a doc. It was funny, me and Dylan, maybe 3 years ago, Dylan was talking about this a lot, a documentary looking at crisis actors and this new thing called QAnon. And it was really hard to even pitch something like that, because at the time it was such a niche thing. No one really understood what it was. And so with something like a newsletter that I write, I can just write about the stuff in real time. It spreads, it has an audience, and it's also kind of a way for me to get ideas in my own head as far as researching goes that may then turn into another thing. And I've got proof of concept in the fact that, hey, here's a thing. It's been read this many times. Look at this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. There's an immediacy to it that you don't necessarily have even with making your own YouTube video or whatever, because it just takes time to like shoot it and edit it, and in a way that that pressure doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's the immediacy, and that's what I missed being in a newsroom, is the immediacy of something. And I guess just today I sent out a newsletter that I wrote in a couple of hours, because we are getting this crazy QAnon conspiracy talk entering the country. We've got a QAnon-aligned political party now. We had the leader of the opposition last night basically get up there and fuel a bunch of conspiracy theories. And so I can package all that information up in a way that people that haven't been sort of keeping up with this and don't understand it, they can read this newsletter and hopefully it gives them all the background they need to sort of make more informed decisions. And that's not something, you know, I can get that out quickly, efficiently. It helps me process the world as well, which is why I think like a lot of us do this kind of stuff. And it doesn't take like 3 years to make like a documentary does.
There's also like the ask of someone who is consuming it too. You know, it's, I think it's a lot easier to ask someone to read an article. Like, oh, I'm forwarding you an email. Check out this email. They can start it, yeah, and stop it whenever they want. You know, if you send them a YouTube video, it's like a bigger ask. Like they can't read it while they're at work, for instance. Or they can't watch a video while they're at work. Not that that many people are at work these days. So there's something also about the medium that like aids in consumption. There's just different consumption patterns too, you know?
Yeah, and I think the thing I like about a newsletter as well, like I've got a small audience, but they like my work and they're engaging, and I'm even just enjoying the comment section because it's not like this forest fire of like Twitter and IMDb comments and YouTube comments. It's like a really, I don't know, like it's a really smart community of people, and I really like engaging and writing for this small group of people. And then the joy of it, if some of these newsletters are free, you can post them publicly and then they go super wide, which is another amazing kind of tool. So yeah, I'm kind of loving it. It's old school, right? Like emailing on a newsletter. It's like, welcome back to the 90s.
Indeed. One thing that's also great about it too, though, is like you can take the audience with you, right? I mean, I don't want this to become an advertisement for newsletters, but like, you know, whenever, if Substack ever shuts down, you just like export all your subscribers and then you move over to somewhere else, which is not something you can do with Twitter or Facebook or anything like that. So
no, and I think we've become way too reliant on these other big mediums. And if, you know, they're not under our control, we don't own the content. And plus those places are, I think, ethically getting pretty dicey to be even using right now. You know, I feel dirty when I'm on Facebook doing stuff.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about coronavirus and conspiracy theories. But first, I want to talk about coronavirus. Overall, how has your life been impacted since coronavirus became a thing?
It's a bit of both. I mean, I was meant to be back in America at the moment working on a project over there, but you know, here I sit in New Zealand with no travel plans for the foreseeable future. So I guess it's changed a lot in a way, but at the same time, I can keep doing what I do. I mean, part of the joy of working in this field is that you can get other ideas off the ground, i.e. start a newsletter. I'm finishing a documentary here at the moment. So there's things to do. I mean, I guess I just feel grounded, like, and I can't complain because I'm in a pretty good position here in New Zealand, but it's just, it's a rough time. Like, you're cut off. You don't know when life is going to go back to normal. You know, my dad just started chemo in the city today, and I can't go and visit him in hospital because of COVID. So, like, everything is different, and everything is a warped version of what it was. So it's a strange time to be living.
We hear stories, you know, in our media about Jacinda Ardern and how she handled the crisis. And in general, it's been the coverage has been extremely positive in the U.S. about like how she's dealt with it. I'm curious, as somebody who lives in New Zealand, how do you feel like your prime minister has handled the crisis in your country? How do you compare that to how Trump has handled it here?
Oh, I mean, it's worlds apart. And I mean, I mean, I'm a raging liberal lefty, so of course I'm going to say this. But I think just objectively, you cannot look at how Jacinda has handled things and not feel really proud and happy. I mean, our stats are all incredible in regards to the virus. I feel safe in this country. I feel looked after. Whereas I look at America, and I look to a place, even just a state like Florida, where, you know, I keep in touch with Richard Ivey from Tickled, who's in Florida, and it is just, it's beyond, you know, like there's just no communication. I think citizens don't know what's going on. And watching Trump just have this blatant disregard for science and medical professionals is, and people, I think, at the root of it all, is, it's just hard to watch. So yeah, I feel proud of being a New Zealander. I feel proud for being associated with something that's not just Lord of the Rings and Flight of the Conchords, as much as I love those things.
It's Lord of the Rings, Flight of the Conchords, and managing to contain the coronavirus crisis, at least for now. Equally important things.
They're the same thing. They're the same thing, Dave.
They're the same magnitude in terms of their impact on society. In recent issues of Webworm, your newsletter on Substack, you've written a lot about conspiracy theories, and you're extremely upset by them. I, David Chen, am extremely upset by them as well. But there are many things that can bother you about coronavirus, right? There's like racial disparity and how it impacts people, and like how it's taking advantage of our decimated medical system or the elder care system, especially in the United States. I'm talking about, right?
Absolutely.
So we can't. We as human beings can't focus on everything all the time. So we have to choose things to focus on. So I'm not saying you should be focusing on these other things, David. But I'm curious, like, why conspiracy theories speak to you specifically?
I think you know, for one thing, I've always been fascinated by conspiracy theories. I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, like The X-Files. That's a show about conspiracy theories, essentially. And so I'm just fascinated by that. But I think since sort of the rise of Alex Jones and InfoWars and just this blatant disregard for reality, I've become particularly fascinated by them. And just how that has risen up along with social media and the flaws we've seen there. I think it's the biggest risk to our democracy is these ideas creeping in, because you're not dealing with reality anymore. You're dealing with like an alternate reality game. It's like made up. We're not even having a conversation about anything that's real. And I think when you have in the United States someone like Trump, who in one day last month, I think, retweeted 14 QAnon accounts in the one day, where you've got a president that is fueling this stuff on. And when I see in New Zealand that that's starting to happen as well with some of our leaders and some of some politicians or people getting involved in politics, it's scary, man. Like, I'm watching friends of mine change the way they think about the world, and it's not in any kind of positive way, and I find that incredibly alarming.
It sounds like the thing that upsets you is that it almost changes the fundamental rules of the game, right? Or the fundamental assumptions we have living in a society, right? Which is like, facts matter. There is a set of knowable facts that we can debate about, you know, how those facts impact each one of us and what policies we should use to impact them. But like, if people are caught up in these theories that have no basis in fact, and they refuse to be convinced otherwise, then it makes any kind of accord impossible, right? And that's a very scary idea.
And it speaks to everything. I mean, the thing with QAnon specifically, which is kind of this overarching conspiracy that sort of rules all other conspiracy theories, is like it's rooted in like a lot of racism and a lot of anti-Semitism. And so I think it all bleeds in. Like, I think all the narrative around Black Lives Matter, which is this incredibly important movement, that's all warped and changed when the discussion around it is with people who believe that, you know, Hillary Clinton is rounding up babies and draining their blood in underground tunnels. You know, it's like we can't possibly have a sane conversation about any of this stuff when an increasing amount of the population is not dealing in any kind of grounded, non-racist reality. Like, and that's really scary to me. And I mean, say what you like about Trump. One extraordinary thing he's done, which is like extraordinarily terrible, but he has created this new kind of politics where the truth does not even begin to matter. And he's moving at such a pace where he can just say something and say more things that are absolutely not in reality, but there's no accountability. It doesn't change anything for him. Like, if anything, it's proven that that just makes him more popular. And again, I'm starting to see some of that reflected in politics here in New Zealand, which, you know, I sit here on my high horse in New Zealand being like, oh, we've got no COVID cases, you know, we're great, like our politics is great. It's like, no, we are starting to get your shit over here as well in this way of thinking and and running things. And I hate it all, Dave. Like, I really, really hate it.
Yeah, it seems, you know, it seems to really catch you on an emotional level, you know, which, to be honest, surprises me, because I've watched your work in Tickled and Dark Tourist, and, you know, you're having conversations with assassins and, you know, dealing with all kinds of, like, terrible things, and you in general seem, I would describe your range of emotion as unfazed to befuddled, right, in general.
Yeah,
and but meanwhile, this QAnon stuff is really has gotten your goat based on just reading. Like, I can feel the emotion coming through that you're, like, furious at this. Is there a reason? Like, why does this get you so much more on an emotional level?
It's so ignorant, and it's not based in reality. Like, if I'm talking with Popeye, like Pablo's hitman. Rest in peace.
Pablo Escobar's cancer. Hitman, right?
Yeah. And, you know, this is a guy who's killed over 300 people. He's killed his girlfriend and carrying his unborn child. Objectively awful human being. But, like, talking to him, I understand how he was raised, what he got into. He's objectively a terrible person, but it makes sense what the reality that I'm in. Like, I understand that. With QAnon, there's no making sense of why we're watching people within the space of a couple of weeks go from really reasoned human beings who are talking about things that are real to people who are suddenly believing not just one conspiracy theory, but believing in all of them. And we're in a different place to where we were when people were debating, when people were debating something like 9/11, where there was still some outlandish stuff in there. But if you believed in that 9/11 was an inside job, or however you want to frame it, it didn't necessarily mean that you thought the moon landing was fake. Now we're in this position where, like, if you believe one, you believe all of them. And I just find that, yeah, it does. I guess it winds me up, because I just see there's no logic in it. It's the absence of truth, and that just it frustrates me, I suppose. Mm.
In a recent edition of your newsletter entitled "Why Hashtag Save Our Children Is Not About Saving Our Children," you talk about this thing. It was covered in the New York Times today too. I sent you this article, right? But you got to it first, David Ferrier. You got to it first.
Thanks.
You scooped the New York Times.
Webworm.
Webworm. Check it out. So essentially, QAnon conspiracy theorists have co-opted Save the Children campaigns because, you know, they believe that moneyed elites are running sex trafficking rings and that Trump is going to stop them all, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Is that the rough?
That's the rough kind of outlines of it,
right? Yeah. And so they're like, a lot of people are kind of enticed by this idea that they can stop these people from trafficking children, sex trafficking mm-hmm. children. And mm-hmm. So they've co-opted, like, the hashtag. They've co-opted, helplines for sex trafficking, calling into these helplines with complete nonsense. Mm-hmm. And it actually does actual damage to these quite legitimate causes. But I think that when I look at these conspiracy theorists, right, there's been a lot of analysis about why people believe in these things, right? There's many reasons why they might believe in these things, but the Save the Children thing really, to me, feels like the logical endpoint of it, which is that if you believe in a conspiracy theory, you basically believe you know something that everyone else doesn't, right? That you are special in some way. You're chosen in some way. You have this knowledge that no one else has. And people who believe in the hashtag Save the Children campaign or Save Our Children is like, not only do they know something people don't, but, like, they are literally doing the most noble action possible, saving children, right?
Absolutely.
There's nothing more noble you can do than saving children.
No, there's not.
So it's fascinating how it preys upon people's weaknesses in their personality, right? It's about, like, people desire to be the hero of their own story. They desire to be special. And so they believe these things because it gives them that. And that's very intoxicating, right? And I don't know what the solution is for it, although you do interview Travis View, who has some ideas about that. But, like, when you think about how to convince someone to not believe in a conspiracy theory, like, what are some ideas you settled on?
Once people are down that rabbit hole, it's really difficult to get them back out. But I think the best way is just to try and have a conversation with someone. I mean, the Save the Children thing has been fascinating to watch because, you know, in the real world, you've got a really pig-headed Miami Herald reporter who chased that story down and exposed Jeffrey Epstein, a really moneyed elite individual who, you know, had sex with, at times, underage women. So, you know, there's your sex trafficker right there. But what QAnon has done, they've come out and jumped on board and got this whole Save Our Children campaign trending, because not only are terrible people at times doing terrible things, and of course human trafficking is a real thing, and of course child sex trafficking is a real thing, but what they're saying is that, you know, this is happening on a grand scale, where ultimately kids are being rounded up in basements such as at Comet Ping Pong, Pizzagate, for the end game of them being so terrified that they get adrenochrome in their blood, this chemical that when drained, so they sort of eventually end up draining these kids' blood, it then gives the elites like superhuman strength. That's kind of like, that's where this stuff goes into this like la la land. And also if you sort of turn up to one of these Save Our Children marches, which seems fairly innocuous, pretty quickly you're going to be rubbing up against all the other Q ideas, which are incredibly damaging. So I like to think that, you know, I've talked to Travis View about this, and I've talked to people like Mick West. He's the guy that designed the Tony Hawk series of video games, got so rich off that he retired and became a conspiracy theory debunker. But both those men basically say you can't get angry. You've just got to try and open up a dialogue, find common ground, and just try and sort of talk around these things and find where you both stand, and then try and talk out against it. But it's really hard to do.
Yeah, his advice, Travis's advice, was a little bit, let's say, contradictory, I think, right? Because he says here, there are two effective ways to get under their skin. Firstly, point out that despite the fact they fancy themselves researchers and defenders of children, they're useless. And then he mentions Julie K. Brown as a traditional journalist who, like basically empirically, the people who have actually done the stopping of the sex trafficking are, you know, people in the mainstream media. Like, no one from QAnon has actually prevented any crimes from happening. No. In fact, they've instigated crimes, you know. And then he says they're useless in helping children, you know. Their deranged Wayfair conspiracy theory jammed the National Human Trafficking Hotline, actually putting more potential human trafficking victims at risk. So, I mean, first of all, that probably would get under the skin. I don't know that it would actually bring them back. But then he says, secondly, pity them. Not in a patronizing way, but because they always deserve pity. They're scared, lost, angry, and they can't tolerate uncertainty about what the future holds, end quote. And that's really where it comes from, right, David? It comes from this idea of it is more comforting to think that there are these powerful people that control everything that's happening and are the source of all your pain and the source of all evil in the world than that. Than to contemplate the truth, which is that we live in an extremely random, terrifying universe, right?
No, that's exactly it. It's a, you know, the world is complicated and it's gray and it's very confusing. QAnon offers up this, so it's like a religion. It offers up this easy answer. It has a savior in Donald Trump. You know, these people think that Donald is suddenly going to step up and reveal the truth behind all of this stuff. Like, it's magical thinking. And I'd further it. I'd say that it is because people are scared and they want answers. But it's also like, I think for a lot of people into this stuff, it's kind of fun for them in a way, because it's a game. Like, it is like picking the pieces apart and putting them together in random ways and making these links. It's kind of fun. And again, it's back to that idea of the whole Q movement and this whole conspiratorial way of thinking. It's being like an alternate reality game, which was this thing that was used in sort of film marketing in the 2000s, where out in the real world, you know, the poster for AI, the Spielberg film, in the credit list, it's got at the bottom, this mysterious name, and it's like if you Google them, they're not an actor, they're not a director, who are they? You Google them, you get taken to a website, and that's got more clues, and then you analyze the sound file, and suddenly you'll find there's like a code in it, and that takes you somewhere else. That's all this stuff is. It's people getting like a whole lot of disparate ideas and trying to link them up. And I think the game comes into it, and the gamification of all this comes into it, and it makes people share ideas and spread everything. And I think that's partly why we're at this point we're at.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when I think of like losing people to QAnon, it's like inconceivable to me. You know, there's a subreddit, like I think it's called QAnon Casualties or something like that, or QAnon Casualties, where people share stories of loved ones they've lost to QAnon. I'm curious, like you've had some experience with that. It sounds like you've had people in your social circles that you've lost to QAnon, or are starting to lose to QAnon. What has that been like?
Oh, I mean, it's deeply unusual. I mean, they're typically people, a few of them, I won't name them, but they're into the creative field here in New Zealand, and I've just watched them over Facebook just go down this crazy rabbit hole. I mean, a lot of it happened when we had our first lockdown earlier in the year, when 5G was like the big bad, and that was being installed by the government as a way to weaken our immune system so that COVID would spread, so that the government could then put us into lockdown for a further amount of time and control the population, etc., etc. And it was at this point in New Zealand where people, not my friends, but people were actually going out and setting 5G towers alight because they thought they had to push back. And they were doing this in poorer communities in the far north where people really needed cell communications. So it was doing a lot of damage. And so while I'm watching that going on as we all go into lockdown, I'm watching a few of my friends start to share some of these things around, and then starting to share the pandemic ridiculous fucking film that came out and things like that. And yeah, I didn't know how to deal with it. I tried talking to them, but very quickly realized it was like talking to a cult member. And so my technique has been to unfriend a load of people. But you know, in the last month or so, as I'm writing more about this stuff, I'm trying to come up with ways to communicate with people and try and bring people back, because this is just going to keep happening. Like, this isn't a little phase that's going to fade out. I think we're at this place in the world now, you know, spearheaded by someone like Donald Trump, where reality's out the window and we can't just ignore it. We've got to try and figure out how to have these conversations with people who are scared and try and talk them out of it. So I don't have an answer, but I'm trying to get to that point.
I want to ask you about fear. You strike me as a pretty fearless dude. You know, you have, like I've said, you've talked with assassins, really unsavory people, people who have ruined or ended other people's lives, right?
Mm. Mm.
You've talked to many of these people, and that would scare the crap out of me. And I have to be honest, QAnon people scare the crap out of me. And what I mean by that is, like, they can decide to ruin your life if they want, right? I mean, if there was some coordinated effort targeting you, like, they could make your life very difficult. I'm curious, like, how you conceptualize that fear, if at all. Do you just think, hey, you know what? I'm the journalist. I'm standing up for truth, and I shall suffer the slings and arrows of whatever the world has to throw at me, like, or... Yeah. You know, like, how do you conceive of the notion of fear? Do you experience it? Are you like Jeff Bridges in Fearless, where you can't even feel it?
No, look, for the record, I definitely do have fears about different things in my life. I think with the QAnon situation, you know, in the online way, I have a lot of abuse. I mean, if I want to read terrible things about myself, that's very accessible to me. If I just check my unread DMs on any platform. You know, I haven't been doxxed yet. I haven't had my address leaked. I haven't undergone a lot of the harassment that certainly journalists overseas have gone through. And that may happen. But no, to be honest, I'm not particularly worried. I'm in a very fortunate position. And this probably makes you sound quite sad. But I don't have, like, I'm not married. I don't have small children. I don't have a mortgage. I don't own my own home. I'm like a very versatile, like, I could pack my bags tomorrow and be somewhere else, and no one would be that concerned, except, you know, I'll let a couple of my friends know where I am. So I don't feel that worried about this stuff because I just don't really see any long-term damage it can do to my own life. You're like
Robert De Niro in Heat, right?
Don't
let yourself get attached to anything you're not willing to walk out on in 30 yeah. seconds flat.
I would take that. I would take. Oh my god, it's so funny. Heat just played at the cinema about a week ago. It's such a good film.
It's nice that you have cinemas, David. It's nice that you.
Yeah, well, I saw Interstellar on IMAX last weekend. It was a cinema Amazing. Full of people. It's mad. But no, so I. The Q stuff, like, I'm not personally scared. I'm more just feel scared for the society that we are now living in and that there's no turning back. And I alternate between being really depressed by that, but also trying to keep some sense of humor about it all. I mean, life is absurd just from, like, the get-go. I think you understand that as well as I do. It's just, it's weird that we're alive and breathing in the first place. So all this other stuff is just, like, weird little side plates that we've just got to live with.
Well, I think that is a great place to end it. David Ferrier is a New Zealand-based journalist, the director of the documentary Tickled, and the creator of the TV show Dark Tourist on Netflix. He's currently writing a newsletter called Webworm, which shows his investigations into quirks and oddities. Subscribe to it right now. David Ferrier, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Dave.
That's going to do it today for Culturally Relevant. We're going to have some weekly recommendations in a bit, but first I just want to say that you can find more episodes of this podcast at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Email me at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. This episode was edited and produced by me, David Chen, and it was powered by Simplecast. Check out simplecast.com if you are looking for a great solution for podcast management and analytics. Every week on the show, I like to give something I've been listening to, reading, watching, smelling, drinking, etc. And this week, I want to recommend a book that I've been reading called Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. Isabel Wilkerson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. She's recently written a book called Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents. And first of all, it's an amazingly written book. It's beautifully written. You read it, you think through all the stuff that's happened in American history, the stuff that you've lived through, the stuff that you haven't lived through, and she just does such an incredible job of summing it up with force and with thematic heft that I'm left blown away by this book. But I wouldn't say there are that many revelations about like things that have happened. There's certainly like new information that I didn't know, but really what she's trying to do in this book is reframe how we conceptualize the notion of institutional racism, right? She reframes it as this idea of a caste system. Caste systems, we've heard of caste systems before taking place in countries like India. And the idea she puts forth in this book is that we in America have a caste system that we don't acknowledge, that's invisible to us, but nonetheless, it is extremely potent. So I would recommend Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson. It's available right now wherever books are sold, also on Kindle. But do check it out. I think it is a powerful read and is especially important for this time that we're all going through. I also had a chance to ask David Ferrier for some weekly recommendations. Here's what David Ferrier had to say.
Yeah, I mean, I am loving I May Destroy You. I think that's on HBO. I'm loving that show a lot. I'm really loving Escaping the Rabbit Hole. That is Mick West's book about dealing with people, family and friends that are sort of suddenly lost to this conspiracy kind of logic. And I think what would be my final recommend? It's an old one, but I just saw Waves, which came out last year. And I know that film isn't everyone's cup of tea, but I was just blown away. I think it's, if you want a film that like deeply makes you feel something, it might be slightly manipulative, but it also, it's just so, the colors are amazing. I think the cinematography is amazing. I think every performance is amazing. So if you can get Waves on, it's probably streaming in the States and it's available elsewhere. I really recommend that film. And it's another score by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, which is, I've been listening to that while I work and it's a really, really good score.
All right, so that's Waves, I May Destroy You, and what was the other one?
Escaping the Rabbit Hole, a book by Mick
Escaping
West.
The Rabbit Hole. All right. Escaping the Rabbit Hole, Waves, and I May Destroy You. Thank you for sharing that with us, David.
No, I appreciate you having me on the show, Dave. I'm a fan, so thanks.
Super grateful to David Ferrier for appearing on the podcast this week. And thank you so much for listening to Culturally Relevant. If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share about it on your social media. It would mean a lot. You can also follow this podcast on Twitter at CREF Show. Leave a review for us on Apple Podcasts if you have a chance. We'd be so grateful for it. All right. That's it. Thanks. We'll see you next week.